This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
This is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
And with brought to you by Pelgrane Press.
Stuff we have to talk about in this episode include...
Classic Monsters versus Cthulhu.
Turn of the Century Fantasy Essentials.
And my Portland Book Raid. Well, I sure am glad President Cat greenlit the Catstronauts' mission to expand the International Space Station. I hear he signed the authorization by swatting a pen across the floor. True leadership right there.
Giant laser pointers in space? What's not to like? And even better, the space station has live stream cameras. Although, half the time it's just nose boops. Let's check how the Catstronauts are doing up there on the space station.
Oh man, there goes Waffles the pilot. He's off to see how many kibble bits can achieve orbit around his belly. A pioneer in snackodynamics, that cat.
Here comes the kitty technician, Blanket. Careful, Waffles. If he catches you clogging the air filters with crumbs again, then it's back to litter box duty for you.
Wait a second, Robin. Major Meowser just got a hair-raising transmission from HQ. Is that the new napping module on its way?
Yep, it's their first space station edition. Science Officer Pom Pom better know what to do, or there'll be a... catastrophe in 3, 2, 1.
Here she is, and she's sharpening her claws on the instruction manual. Well, it might accidentally flip to the right page with enough swiping, I guess.
Look at them working together. Waffles is keeping the station steady with his prodigious belly. Blanket is swatting at the module's fasteners like a feather toy. Pom Pom finally found the right instructions, and Major Meowser is, napping on them? Teamwork, by golly!
Hooray for the Catstronauts!
The space station is saved!
Until the next module arrives and starts another near-catastrophe, that is.
Wow, managing your own space station with a crew of feline heroes. Now that's the life!
You know you can, Robin. The official Catstronauts board game is available now from Atlas Games. It's full of pawsome color art by the comic book's creator, Drew Brockington, and Catstronauts features cooperative play that's fun for all ages. Find out more at atlas-games.com/catstronauts.
Sounds like the Catstronauts board game is perfect for the whole family. Let's meet this stellar challenge by picking up the Catstronauts board game now! So, Ken, before we get started, I believe you have a preamble hut.
I do, and I'm just going to briefly put on one of my many hats to plug Subversive Sci-Fi Evolution, which is a book of film criticism. It's the fifth in the series from Ghost Show Press, the Everyone's Gone to the Movies series, in which many names familiar to you from role-playing creativity get to flex their creative muscles while discussing film. This one is science fiction movies that evolve the genre, and my choice was Scanners by Robin's national hero, David Cronenberg. And I hope I found something interesting to say about it. You can find out by backing the Kickstarter, which is going on now. The rattle of bones. The thump of Frankenstein boots. The crunch of neck arteries. And the benevolent gaze of the invisible man coming alive. Welcome us once more into the gaming hut, where we've got the gaming hut decorated for Halloween. There's orange and black crepe paper. We've got all the Halloween candy that we stole from deserving children down in the middle of the table. But we are going to not talk about gaming straight up Halloween, which is a great concept, but one I think that has been done a good bit, but one in which we game, maybe this is a one shot, maybe this is a little moment, maybe it's something you just do through October next year or through the winter this year, ending on a Christmas episode, because we're going to do a Halloween inspired, though not themed, campaign frame, I guess you'd call it, right, Robin?
Or just a game, since we haven't figured out what mechanics we want to use for this. So
yeah, whatever.
Yeah, so I thought this is our Halloween episode. The other segments are taken up with non-Halloween-y things. So instead of doing a horror hut, the gaming hut has to take over. So I thought, what's the most Halloween-y possible premise for a game? And that is the classic monsters fighting the Cthulhu mythos. And we have done Shadows Over Filmland, Ken and I, which is a more serious take using all of those different universal monster tropes and then translating them into the mythos. But I thought here we would have sort of a more fun kind of monster mash game where instead of running away from Dracula and fleeing Frankenstein, you are the classic monsters and the mythos remains as the villains, as the bad guys. So we could do this, I guess, in a more sort of serious thing. You could probably do this with World of Darkness even, right? Aren't there enough correspondences
so.
Between...
You got your Promethean, you got your vampire, you got your mummy, you got your werewolf, obviously. You might have to go a little bit into the guts to get your werewolf to be properly emo so that he was Lon Chaney Jr., not some ravening beast from The Howling. But still, I think that you could do it using that system. The Cthulhu mythos is a little tougher to work in, although I believe Scion did a Cthulhu mythos. That hasn't been upgunned into fifth edition, but, you know, it's all basically the same sort of thing, and you could figure it out. And, hey, maybe that's fun if the Cthulhu monsters use the old rules that existed before. And
yes, if you get too close to Nyarlathotep, you have to use the botch rules again.
Right. Yeah, but you have to use botch dice. That's what he does to you, that jerk.
So whatever system we're using, this is, as you suggest, probably a little dish that you have as a special occasion or a pause between more serious games, because I think really you probably want to lean into the fun of this rather than try to do the emo version. So I guess the first question, we know from the Universal movies, the later ones, that the different creatures do meet up. Sometimes they fight, sometimes they team up. So I guess the first step, of course, is to have your, if this is one shot, not a session zero, but your half hour zero, where everybody decides which of those monster types they want to play. And I guess you give them the option of, do you want to be full on Bela Lugosi or do you just want to be a vampire?
A Dracula.
Right. And so, you're not literally playing the actor Bela Lugosi. You're playing the Bela Lugosi Dracula. Or do you want to play some other vampire that you invent? Or even, I suppose, especially if they're more than one person wanting to play the vampire, do you want to pick another vampire from cinema history, right? Do you want to be Catherine Deneuve from The Hunger or something? And I guess we have the option for not only Frankenstein's monster, but to have a actual Frankenstein can be in the group. You can have, you need a mad scientist. He can be your techie. So you've got your sort of, I guess really your Dracula is kind of your magician sorcerer kind of guy with extra superpowers. You've got your Brick in the form of your Frankenstein's monster. If no one wants to play him, the werewolf can also perform that. And perhaps it's the werewolf is the more ferociously attacky guy, and the Frankenstein monster is the one who can absorb the hits. You've got your ninja already in the Invisible Man. Your oddball character can be taken by the creature from the Black Lagoon. And am I leaving anybody out there?
You've left out the mummy, who can also be a sorcerer type.
Oh, right. Yeah. And he can sort of compete for, if hypnotism needs to happen during the day, I guess the mummy does that. And at night, then he and Dracula can roll dice or do rock, paper, fangs in order to determine who gets to go and do the hypnotism. So the next question, Ken, is what is it that has caused all of these creatures to become aware of the mythos and then band together to combat it?
Well, in the traditional Universal story and in the lovely film Monster Squad, which is the closest I think we get so far to a tribute to this that's done correctly, usually it's Dracula's got some sort of evil scheme. He has roped Frankenstein's monster in as a goon. And then the Wolfman, in a access of emo pity for humanity, stops him. They sort of flip that around a little bit in Monster Squad, which is very fun and interesting and should be watched. But usually Dracula's got some scheme. So I feel like, to honor the premises, Dracula is in the, you know, he's getting ready for some scheme. He's going to, you know, he's noticed that the stars are going to come right, and then he's going to be able to turn all of Earth into vampires, or he's going to turn, you know, everyone into vampires except for, you know, the people who don't have his blood blessing or something. And so he's getting ready to rule an America of vampires. And then he notices, because he's our, or maybe the mummy notices, because he's the other occult scholar, and that's how we bring them together. The mummy, who knows all about Nyarlathotep, of course, notices that the stars are coming right. Nyarlathotep is getting ready to usher in the end times. and that this blood moon that Dracula's counting on is part of those end times. And the mummy, again, has seen this all before, and he goes to Dracula, and he has his friends. So normally it's Dracula and Frankenstein, and then the Wolfman is hunting them. Maybe the mummy is the guy who brings in the Invisible Man and the Black Lagoon, Gilman. And so those two teams sort of meet Avengers style. Maybe they have a fight because it's a role-playing game, or maybe as they're just about to have a fight, Nyarlathotep shows his hand and out come the hunting horrors or whatever, and you have to fight them off with your monster powers. And Dracula realizes that, oh, he's going to have to forego the blood moon, because if he selfishly tries to turn America into vampires, well, very shortly, America will be turned into sea bottom by Great Cthulhu. So he has to stop that from happening. Meanwhile, Nyarlathotep, I think, again, because we're doing this sort of universal style, he'd be a more human mocking character in the way that he is in Dream Quest, is sort of like always showing up and messing with them with different monsters that they have to fight. Nyarlathotep is sort of undoing the seals to the end times. And you can even do that as, you know, he's unlocking other Halloween movies. So one of Nyarlathotep's seals is that the little town of Haddonfield, Ohio goes crazy and people start stabbing all the babysitters, and the Universal monsters have to stop that. And you can have a little Targets feeling where the outmoded monsters have to stop modern terrors. They have to stop a zombie outbreak, right? They have to stop, you know, some sort of horrendous flesh-eating bacteria, all the various modern era monstrosities, an alien invasion, and they have to stop it in sort of a tribute to Lovecraft's own aesthetics a little bit, in that we're doing throwback horror in this sense to fight off hated modernity.
Right. So the we kind of the Quiet Place aliens show up and stage a bit of an invasion, and perhaps that's a more easily dealt with by sorcery than by ordinary people, and they could create a cone of silence around themselves as the a way of solving that problem, and they could wind up having to go to this horrible farm in Texas where they find a bunch of cannibals who normally they make excellent Renfields, but they've been they've been turned and are creating something with essential salts in the basement. So I think that could be a lot of fun, is to have the old-timey monsters make war on all of the newer and to their mind, of course, inferior horror. So they could go to Eastern Europe and find this place where mere mortals are just torturing each other. That's stupid. And they can finish those guys off pretty quick. And they could deal with the saw puppet. There's a whole raft of different possibilities there. And you can have the fly can show up. And is the fly on your side? Is the fly on their side? Who knows? They could be sort of a tug of war for the loyalties of those two creatures. So this is sort of turning into a campaign full of references, almost sort of a Kim Newman situation is unfolding before our eyes here.
Yeah. And I think that this is really, you know, one of the easier ones to figure out, because you just do what we did in Shadows Over Foamland, except we do it for these post-classic monsters, and we figure out which mythos threat those vibe with. So the guys in Eastern Europe who are just torturing everyone are clearly, you know, being run by the Migo, because the Migo are the guy with the laboratory and sawing out people's brains and doing stuff like that. The saw puppet that's making people solve puzzles, he's clearly a great race of Yith projection of some kind, trying to sort out the superior mind so that he can occupy it. You could do all manner of things with these dudes, and that can be sort of
the witch who makes kids run out of the house at 2:37 a.m. is clearly just from a witch house, and
right,
probably has a brown Jenkin with her.
Yeah, the story writes itself, really, and then you just figure out which horror movie is your climax, and is it going to, you know, come all the way back around, and Nyarlathotep has actually been, you know, sending out his somnambulists all along, and you have to stop his human form, Dr. Caligari, at the very end? Or is it that you are, you know, when we are ratcheting up, you get to fight like Godzilla, and that's also Cthulhu. Godzilla comes rising up out of the ocean near Japan, and you have to put him down somehow. But whatever your climax is, you know, you can build to that, leaving clues in all the other keys that Nyarlathotep is turning. And that, I think, would be a very sort of a satisfyingly, as you say, Kim Newman-esque set of experiences.
Right. And that creates the thought that, you know, what if Dracula bites Godzilla? And again, Speaking of things writing themselves, we don't have to go any further with that. That can be your next thing, all the vampire kaiju fighting. But we have a lot to cover this episode, so let's consider our work done there and head on over into this new exciting hot ore segment that waits for us on the other side.
Moving drama.
Hilarious comedy.
And you are the sole protagonist.
Page-Turners is my game of personal storytelling for one player and one GM.
Coming soon from Pelgrane Press.
Longtime listeners know Hillfolk, my game of dramatic group play.
Winner of the coveted Diana Jones Award.
Page-Turners shifts its dynamic down to the intimate scale of a single main character whose fiction you weave on the fly with one other creator.
Shockingly simple rules keep the focus on emotional interaction.
Extensive guidance helps you shape satisfying outcomes.
Writers Sarah Sam Saltiel, Wade Rocket, and Ruth Tillman join Robin in presenting 11 scenarios spanning a wealth of genres and tones.
Scenarios include
Jazz Age Ambition and Glamour,
A Childhood Haunted by Strife and a Shadowy Being,
Deceit and Survival on the Spaceship Earth Again,
A Stay in Bath takes an unexpected turn in the Austin-inspired Entreaty and Entanglement,
The Screwball 30s Hijinks of Loose Screws,
The Shakespearean Comedy of Love's Loyal Laborers,
A Love Triangle Unfolding from the Turbulent 60s to the Troubled 20-teens,
Behind the Music Drama in the L.A. Punk Scene,
The Arrival of a Telepathic Stranger on a Spacebound Way Station,
Tragic Love Between a Vampire and a Mortal,
and an epic multi-generational saga of artificial beings attempting to build a civilization in the tradition of that extinct species, Homo sapiens.
Gorgeously laid out and illustrated by graphic superstar Jen McCleary.
Whoever you want to be, wherever your imagination takes you,
whether your journey leads to Union Doom or something harder to define,
Page Turners unleashes your story in new and unexpected ways. Once more, we walk down the carpeted aisles. We're not quite in the multiplex, but we're certainly in the multiplex because it's right around the turn of the century. Late 90s, the popcorn may still be that weird chemical coconut oil butter, which always smells great. And you don't taste it that much. You just think about tasting it. The projector's still a film projector, but the center seats in the center aisle are still the best seats here in the Fantasy Film Essentials Film Festival. And as we're looking over the program, I can't help but notice that Small Soldiers, 1998, Joe Dante, an A++ movie in every respect, a biting satire as much of later Dante became, but still fun and joyful as early Dante always was. But sadly, it's science fiction because it involves computer chips, not magic, even though it's about living toys and a teen boy trying to get with a teen girl and all the other great fantasy tropes. But it is, in fact, science fiction. Should it have been a science fiction essential? Well, whomst among us can say now. At any rate, we have to regretfully put the postcard for that down because we're about to talk about 1998's Sliding Doors, directed by Peter Howitt.
So this is, I think, something that you might sleep on as a fantasy film, but of course, absolutely is. This is, if you don't know the premise, it's a romantic drama in which Gwyneth Paltrow plays a woman named Helen Quilley, who lives in London, and we see two versions of her life, one in which she gets onto a tube train and the other in which she narrowly misses getting on the tube train. In the first one, she discovers that her crummy boyfriend is messing around on her and then finds a new charming guy. In the second one, she doesn't make that discovery, and the film entwines different versions of her lives in what is a sort of a dreamy styled romantic drama. You often hear it described as a romantic comedy because apparently people have never heard of the fact that romantic dramas exist. It ain't a comedy.
It's not a comedy, no.
Right. But it is sort of it does lead you to question the idea of alternate timelines and what would happen in your personal timeline. So it's not a big story. It's a personal, intimate story. And then without blowing the ending, if you haven't seen it, there is a further indication of something fantastical happening, but is a interesting mood piece that sort of partakes. It almost sort of translates kind of a a Dunsinane sense into an utterly modern contemporary story, and has a strong cast. John Hannah plays the good boyfriend in the good timeline. John Lynch is the appropriately Weasley is the Weasel boyfriend. And it's something that, again, you see echoed again later in different versions.
Yeah, it's a charming movie, while also, as you say, not being remotely a comedy. And Gwyneth Paltrow has seldom been more appealing. I am not really a subscriber to the Gwyneth Paltrow experience, but I will say in Sliding Doors, you really see what a good actress she is, and you really see her turn on the sort of a wounded fawn charm that I think is sort of the core to at least her earlier performances before she became Pepper Potts and America's Sweetheart and the rest of that. Sliding Doors is a really great movie, and as an alternate history movie that no one ever talks about, it has always consumed my mind. What if there was a Sliding Door somewhere in which Sliding Doors had launched a whole series of alternate timeline movies in the same way that Groundhog Day launched a whole swath of time loop movies, if only, but still well worth seeing. Speaking of films that are well worth seeing, we're moving into 1999 now, where, spoiler, we will stay for a bit. It's another one of those banger years. This is Spike Jonze's film Being John Malkovich, which is also the screenwriter Charlie Kaufman's film Being John Malkovich, because all of his fingerprint concerns are all over it. John Cusack plays a puppeteer named Craig Schwartz. He is, as a puppeteer, a schlub and basically a failure in life. He goes to work for an eccentric guy and discovers that there is a tiny door in the building where he works that leads into the mind of John Malkovich. The beloved actor, John Malkovich, who plays himself in the film. He has a wife, Cameron Diaz, because he is sort of a schlub. She is falling out of love with him. While in the brain of John Malkovich, he meets Catherine Keener, who is sort of more of his spirit. So they have all this triangle going on. Meanwhile, Orson Bean, the malevolent Dr. Lester, who built the trapdoor into John Malkovich, is mad that a puppeteer is wasting it. And so hijinks, increasingly surreal and messed up hijinks, ensue. There's never a dull moment in the movie. There's never a moment where you say, oh, that old business again. It's always inventive. It's always wild. And the fact that it lost the Oscar for best screenplay should cause you to hurl the Academy Awards from you as a poisonous, a venomous thing, even. So it's a triumph in screenplay, but also in production.
Yes, it's the first movie from Kaufman. It's the first movie from Jones. It is the one where his spirit of invention, I think, floats higher than his despair, and it makes it still, I think, one of the most accessible of his scripts. And the craziness of having John Malkovich play Malkovich, especially the recursive Malkovich's scene, is something quite brilliant. And also just all the little weird, it's not just a fantasy film with that premise, but also there are other surreal touches, like the office that the Cusack character goes to work in being a half floor where everybody has to bend over. And that's just never really explained, except this is a sort of a weird version of our own universe. So it's blending the surreal with the overtly fantastical. Next, we come to Dogma, also from 1999. This is Kevin Smith's closest stab to a big commercial rollicking action movie, which fuses his scatological, dialogue-driven sensibility with a bigger, a blockbustery sense. This is another sort of fantastical gloss on biblical imagery. And so we have Ben Affleck and Matt Damon as renegade angels who have just decided to go around executing sinners. And the trick then is to prevent them from entering heaven in order to destroy everything. Linda Fiorentino provides the human grounding as Bethany Sloan. You've got a whole other great raft of comic actors, including other Smith mainstays like Jason Lee playing different unearthly beings, of which certainly Alan Rickman as Metatron is a big standout. His comic timing has, I think, never been sharper than in this. And it has finally been freed. The rights have been sat on by Harvey Weinstein for many years, but it's had a little revival run, and so people had a chance to see it this summer. But it's a fun film, and it's a weird film for Kevin Smith in that he demonstrated his chops to pull something like this off on this scale, and then after went, nah, it's too much work, and went back to doing his more regular shtick.
Yeah, it's a wild spectacle just on its own. Really, it's just watching for all those actors. It's like one of those 60s, you know, jam everyone in movies like The Great Race or It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. You want to see who turns up on the screen next. And also, it is weirdly Kevin Smith expressing sort of a agonized statement about the state of Christianity. It's not hating on Christianity. It's not Christianity is valueless. It's Christianity has been murked by the sort of the organized apparatus of making money off Christianity. And that is an interesting take for anyone in Hollywood to take. And it's certainly an interesting take for someone whose sort of nihilist comic sensibility has been as fundamental to his work as Kevin Smith. So in a lot of ways, it's the most philosophically interesting, but it also certainly some people will bounce off it. But to those people, I say, just wait around until God shows up and everything will be made right.
Your enthusiasm for Toy Story continues with your praise and elevation of Toy Story 2.
Yeah, Toy Story 2, I believe, and many believe, is actually even better than Toy Story, while in no way negging the original film, which is something that sequels and especially Disney sequels are generally bad at. The notion that Woody is found by a evil toy collector, someone who reduces IP to content. I think maybe he could see the mouse getting ever closer to Pixar. John Lasseter put a lot of himself into it. That famously got torn down to the studs and rebuilt in about 9 months by him and his team. But it is still in execution, smooth and brilliant. The animation of the camera work is some of the best that animation had produced up until that time. You know, Chuck Jones loved it, which is all the, you know, canonicity you would need, I would think. But once more, Tim Allen is Buzz Lightyear, Tom Hanks is Woody, the whole cast comes back. We've also got a wheezy penguin who's great, and we have a new Buzz Lightyear, a utility belt Buzz, who's a different version of the same toy and therefore doesn't like Tim Allen. And so we have lots of excitement with that, and then they have to stop the Emperor Zurg. That's their mission, the Buzz Lightyears, while Tom Hanks discovers that he was actually part of a play set from the 50s, and if he wanted to, he'd just stay in the 50s in his play set forever and not have to have existential angst about whether Andy loves him. And that, you know, we reiterate the story, but we don't do the same story where Andy has fallen out of love with him again. He's legitimately lost and missing and busted up. And it becomes a whole different story while still being the Toy Story that we know and love, the same Toy Story universe. And if anything, as I say, the animation is even better than the first one. So it's a visual spectacle as well as being a really affecting and really good story. The Empire Strikes Back of the trilogy, I will say this forever.
Yeah, genre-wise, it upscales into an action rescue thriller. And the animation is more than able to handle that. And as you suggested, it's very interesting that the film is used as a critique, not just of merchandising, but adults loving childish things for the wrong reasons, mm-hmm. both of which, of course, have been somewhat erased by the relentless merchandising of the Toy Story characters. But it is interesting to see that level of awareness going on in a kids' film. So we often talk about there being a layer for adults to appreciate in an animated film. And here we have a layer to sort of have adults questioning why they're even in the theater if they're not there with kids. Mm-hmm. And now finally in 99, we get to The Mummy, directed by Stephen Sommers. This is a perfect evocation of the Saturday morning serial spirit, very cleverly adapts the Universal Mummy property into a whole different genre, in this case, the pulp adventure genre, with just a tone-perfect performance by Brendan Fraser as the handsome, heroic lead. Rachel Weisz is equally charming as Evelyn Carnahan. John Hannah, who we mentioned previously, gets to be a somewhat Weasley third wheel, and an even more Weasley Kevin J. O'Connor gives a great performance that recalls the great weasels of 30s and 40s cinema. You've got Arnold Vosloo showing up as Imhotep, one of the great incarnations of a movie villain and of the mummy in cinematic history. And Oded Fehr also to be another heroic Jod character. So the pacing is great. The special effects were for the time delightful. And I think because they were so well executed, kind of stand up well and comparison to today's sort of overstretched CGI capacity. So of the adventure films, that we're discussing as also being fantasy films, I think this is possibly the most successful.
Yeah, it's certainly, you know, when I went to see a remake of The Mummy, I was just going to see a remake of The Mummy. And what I got was maybe the best adventure film of the 90s and maybe the best adventure film since the 90s in many ways. And speaking of things since the 90s, one of the things that you don't notice as much when you're watching it, when we were watching it at the time, but absolutely you notice now, is how good the lighting is. Everything is visible. Everything is happening. There's that sort of golden desert glow when you want it. The sunset scenes feel like sunset scenes, even down in the crypt. Everything is making sense, blocked correctly, lit correctly. You never have a question as to what is going on or why. It's very, very clearly laid out for you. And a lot of that is just, you know, it's not just the editing. It's not just the directing. It's the lighting. And of all the great cinematic arts that have fallen farthest since 1999, I think lighting is in there. But next time you're watching The Mummy, if you can tear your gaze away from the insanely good-looking leads, give a little look at how you can see those insanely good-looking leads, because that lighting turns out to have been done on purpose and hard, not just a natural part of filmmaking, the way that you and I, perhaps spoiled rotten, thought it was at the time.
Yes. We will return to the idea of 1999 sort of being a high point, and the period after that, with notable exceptions that we will install into the Hall of Fame, sort of a rocky period. So we'll get to that again next week. But this week, we're going to stop listing movies and can start listing some books on the other side of this exciting commercial.
Woohoo!
In the Spiral.
Four scenarios embrace the works and deaths of agents between 2016 and 2020, years called the Spiral and the Delta Green Campaign, God's Teeth.
That span of cruelty and corruption in American government seemed a bitter interregnum.
A momentary eruption of spite.
Now it stands revealed as a preparation for revelations to come.
In God's eye, a baffling disappearance leads the agents to confront the inexorable government panopticon.
They face unnatural revelations unleashed by the death of privacy.
And must survive desperate revenge beneath the sleepless skies.
In God's breath, a Delta Green friendly leaves a frantic voicemail about a Denver prisoner vomiting up an alien worm.
Your agents must identify the unnatural threat.
Trace it to its source.
Burn it out.
Just be careful of the smoke.
In God's law, a shockingly gruesome death leads the agents to a Los Angeles police gang.
It has twisted older, deeper laws towards the tired avarice of corruption.
How far do the agents go to resist the unnatural?
In God's light, the wreckage left by a mass shooter catches Delta Green's attention.
Somehow behind it, a surprising app that reaches strange places on the border between worlds.
The scenarios of God's Hunt are playable with Arc Dream Publishing's Delta Green, the role-playing game.
Play the scenarios on their own, as a cycle, or as a perfect companion to the acclaimed campaign Delta Green, God's Teeth.
Learn more about Delta Green at delta-green.com.
Protect this podcast from getting crushed in a monster mash alongside such beloved Patreon backers as
Yuri Horniman,
Kelly Fisher,
Ryan Mannix,
Scott Jones,
and the Molten Sulfur Blog. So, Ken, listeners have possibly been wondering, what has happened to Ken? Has he stopped buying books? And no, what happened is you put a list of books that you bought in the script and I didn't notice it. So now I'm noticing it. And so let's look at your haul from Powell's. When you go to the Lovecraft Film Festival, you go to Powell's in Portland and you leave with a bunch of books. And this time around, you've left with the ideal number of books to discuss in two segments. So let's get right on that with The Venetian Patriciate, Reality versus Myth by Donald E. Queller.
Yeah, this is from long enough ago that the myth that Donald Queller is addressing is the myth that the patriciate, the upper class of Venice, the ruling class, the noble class, were uniquely civic-minded and unselfish. And apparently, someone believed this at some point, I'm guessing in the 19th century, well after Venice had fallen. But Donald E. Queller is here to say, guess what? If you give a bunch of nobles untrammeled power and secretive governmental strings to pull, you get nothing but the most hilarious and monstrous stories of corruption and self-dealing. So he's here to take the glitter off the Venetian patriciate. So in a way, it's a perfect game book if you're running Swords of the Serpentine in Venice, as I indeed am, because it's going to be nothing but hijinks pulled by rich jerks, which is exactly the sort of story you want your player characters to blunder into, or in my case, marry into, which is so much fun. I can't wait to find out what one of my player characters' new in-laws are getting up to in this period.
Yes, that must be an old myth indeed, because when I think of Venice, I think exactly of backstabbing and intrigue. And right. So I guess Donald E. Queller helped make the new perception. We're going to head on over now to Elizabethan and Jacobean England with Roaring Boys, Playwrights and Players in Elizabethan and Jacobean England by Judith Cook.
Yeah, Judith Cook, I believe, has written some other histories of London and histories of that era. She's pretty familiar with it. This is the sort of, okay, Shakespeare, but what about everyone else? Which is the sort of question that English professors love to ask because they're mad that no one reads their thesis on anyone but Shakespeare. But Shakespeare was at the center of a big community of playwrights, actors, and if you know anything about theater scenes, you know that it's a nest of backbiting. And this is a book about that. And so if you combine a nest of backbiting with a every now and again totalitarian government coming down and throwing one of you in a dungeon, you get a pretty good milieu for story to happen. And the Roaring Boys sort of goes into the what's called the Poets' War, and then the aftermath as the tail end of Elizabeth's reign starts turning even more authoritarian, and, you know, what sorts of ways Ben Jonson and other people had to move themselves politically around to survive while also never letting anyone else get the last word. It's a great sort of an era for human interest story to happen because these are some of the most interesting humans ever, even in 1600 London. And there hasn't really been, or at least I haven't really found, is a sort of a good social, not a social history, but a, you know, a Gossip Girl version, I guess I want to say, of who everyone was mad at and why and what happened to them, you know, sort of laid out in that milieu rather than reading individual biographies. So I was happy to find it.
Now come to one that I have read and can recommend. The Millionaire and the Bard, Henry Folger's Obsessive Hunt for Shakespeare's First Folio by Andrea Mays. This harkens back to an era when extremely rich Americans decided to impress each other by amassing amazing collections of things and then building museums to house them in. And in this case, Henry Folger's specialty was Shakespeareana.
Yeah, and he built the Folger Shakespeare, which if you're any kind of bibliophile or scholar, you've heard about. And this is him trying to get a first folio for America because just because Shakespeare was British doesn't mean the British should have any first folios. This was a Henry Folger's attitude. And so since only America could properly appreciate Shakespeare in the person of Henry Folger, America needs at least one, and one hopes many, first folios. So it's a bookhound story. It's a Shakespeare story. It's a Gilded Age obsession story. You know, it's all these great things happening at once. And as you say, Robin has already recommended and enjoyed it. So what better reason for me to snap it up?
Naples 1343, The Unexpected Origins of the Mafia, is by Amadeo Faniello.
Yeah, this is a guy, he was a Neapolitan teacher. He has witnessed the depredations of the Camorra virtually at first hand, outside the gates of his school, for example, and said, what was that about? Sort of quit his teaching job and started digging around in archives. Most of the Neapolitan archives were obliterated during World War II, so he had to go into family archives and see if he could sort of figure out, parse out what was going on. And he takes the story of the Camorra, the mafia, all the way back to the 14th century when the Angevin monarchy is taking over Naples. And the current power structure, which is a bunch of landowners and with also rich mercantile presences in the city, the Soji is what they're called, they are suddenly not in charge in the court anymore. And how they responded to that was ignoring the king and setting up their own rules. And Faniello looks at a very little known incident where these merchants got together and captured a Genoese galley full of food, and they murdered the captain, and they stole all the goods and sold them into a famine and made even more money. And he says, this is an example. This is basically mafia activity, because the king of Naples has to say, I don't control the city. It is controlled by the families. And that, of course, will set off alarm bells in any mafioso historian. And while I think orthodox historians of the Camorra don't buy it, I think it's a great story to pursue. And if you're interested in setting something in 14th century Naples, this is going to have what goods there are assembled with storytelling elan by Dr. Faniello.
Next up, we have Who Killed Jane Stanford? A Gilded Age Tale of Murder, Deceit, Spirits, and the Birth of a University by Richard White. I don't know this story, but I see that it's up your alley and up my alley in several ways.
Yeah, this is the Jane Stanford is Jane Stanford, wife of Leland Stanford, the railroad tycoon who founds Stanford University with his wife, Jane. She had her own money. And then he dies in 1893, and she's running the university basically by herself. She is also getting ever more into spirituality and spirit summoning. And maybe people are saying, should she be running the university with this wild female attitude? And then while she's in Hawaii in 1905, she is poisoned with strychnine, and they cover it up and they say, oh no, she just died. You know, she was just an old lady, 76 years old. It happens. And then that cover up dropped out. And since they'd covered it up, there was never a really good investigation. So we don't really know what happened, but there is a lot of, you know, rich people with a very strong interest in not letting the truth come out. And this is the book about that, that tries to sort of uncover what's going on.
Yes. Poisoning is almost never a stranger killing.
Right. Yeah. It's always someone who knows someone and has access. And that is, you know, part of the wild excitement of a poisoning case, both in fiction and in fact.
Let's move on to the tradecraft portion of the bookshelf. The Secrets of Spies, Inside the Hidden World of International Agents by Adrian Gilbert, Heather Vesant, and Rob Coulson.
Yeah, this is a big sort of a coffee table-y. It's not from Dorling Kindersley, but it might as well be. Lots of, you know, big two-page spreads full of exciting write-up. So it's not an essential, I would say. But again, as I've mentioned, when I get one of these compendia, I look and I see how late in the book does World War II start? And in this book, this sort of amiable compendium, as I say, it's like 250 pages. World War II doesn't really get started in this book until like page 100 and something. So, I mean, in between, there's a sort of a basics of tradecraft section, but the historical pre-World War II takes you into like page 80 or 90. So we've got, you know, a good chunk of stuff, some of it known, some of it superficial, but some of it just the sort of instant, you know, busy GM's primer type topic. And also, it's a lovely book, and it's very available remaindered, such as at Pell's.
And finally, for this half of the segment, we get to Army Surveillance in America, 1775 to 1980 by Joan M. Jensen.
This is really what it says on the tin. It's the role of the United States Army in erecting a federal surveillance state. That federal surveillance state was obviously more in theory than in actuality up until World War I. But there have been cases where army surveillance, you know, was being exerted against civilian populations. And this goes back to the revolution, as the date indicates. Happens more in the aftermath of, say, the Civil War, when the army mounted a surveillance situation in the South to break the original Ku Klux Klan. And then in World War I, when Woodrow Wilson set up the mass propaganda state and the imprisoning your political enemies state, the army became part of that and sort of flooded into the nature of what the federal government saw as its job. J. Edgar Hoover, of course, famously didn't want the army to be involved in any of this. He wanted the FBI to be involved in it. So now you have the sort of a bureaucratic infighting in lieu of a surveillance state, which I suppose is the best case scenario. And Joan Jensen ends this in 1980, but I think that anyone can sort of imagine that the story does not get more libertarian after that than it was before that. But anyway, it's a good source for historical gaming. Certainly Fall of Delta Green falls into that, and any sort of Western that you want to do, you can sort of set up who your James West and Artemis Gordon are actually working for and what they're actually doing, if you want to tie it to history. So a good overview, even if it's a little dated and certainly not quite up to our modern panopticon.
Well, let's give everybody a chance to see who is watching them while they listen to an exciting commercial, and we'll be back in a moment. The British are coming! The British are coming!
In Flagbearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Thoroughly researched and beautifully illustrated in Nations and Cannons, you play as spies, skirmishers, and saboteurs in the battle for the future of the 13 colonies.
The new campaign guide, The American Crisis, War in the North, covers the early actions of the war with historical adventures, setting information, and a fiendish Hessian plot.
Nations and Cannons is 5e compatible and focuses on unconventional heroes from underrepresented perspectives.
Educators can get a copy of the core book for use in the classroom absolutely free.
The American Crisis is now fully available in print as well as PDF.
Visit nationsandcannons.com to check out a free adventure chapter and the quick start guide.
And we are, as promised, back in Ken's bookshelf. I have not ever read a biography of a cryptologist, and I need to know how that's different from a cryptographer. So let's talk about Parker Hitt, the Father of American Military Cryptology by Betsy Rahalie Smoot.
Yeah, Parker Hitt was, to all intents and purposes, a normal American engineering officer. And in 1914, as World War I is kicking off, he is noticing that our military codes haven't been updated since maybe the Civil War, certainly not the Spanish-American War. And he says, well, surely there has been advancement in codes, and he starts researching it, and he realizes America is desperately behind on codes. And so he writes a manual for what you should do when you're making American codes, and he publishes this, or the Army publishes this, in 1916, and he serves in World War I. He takes the French codes that we were using at the beginning of the war and translates them into English, which is a gigantic step forward because the number of bilingual American officers is not high in 1917 or now. And so he basically establishes sort of best principles for military code use. And the difference is that he would always say, when people said, what was it like making all those codes? He would always say, I never made a code. I'm not a cryptographer. I'm a cryptologist. I study codes and I tell other people how to make them. And the real fathers of American cryptography, or the father and mother of American cryptography, the Freedmans, say absolutely without Parker Hitt, we couldn't have done the work that we did. So yeah, and it's just wild that there hasn't been a biography of him. He's not even a code breaker like Herbert Yardley. He just says, codes are important, don't screw them up. And apparently that was revolutionary in 1916.
So the difference between a cryptologist and a cryptographer is the cryptologist finds cryptographers important enough to fund them.
Right, yeah, right.
And then bosses them around.
Yep.
Okay, next we come to Covert City, The Cold War and the Making of Miami by Vince Houghton and Eric Driggs.
Yeah, Houghton and Driggs make the theory, which I don't think stands up, but is fun, that it was American covert investment in the Cuban exile community that kickstarted the development of Miami as a metropolitan area, you know, a hub of commercial activity and enterprise in Florida. That before the Cold War, Miami was a sleepy little resort town with nothing much going on. We get the Cuban exiles, we get the CIA funding them all, and suddenly there is a boom in Miami, and the commercial boom in Miami happens hand in hand and is in some cases directed by the CIA. I don't think that they make their case, but it is a great, you know, again, so many of these books are great resources for your Fall of Delta Green campaign, but they are also great sort of examples of storylines to pull for any sort of campaign where you're dealing with the shadowy interplay of real estate developers and covert agencies and the degree of chaos that is introduced by simultaneously having to deal with, in theory, foreign revolutionaries is, I think, part of what makes this story specifically interesting, as opposed to sort of a more anodyne story of, yes, without the NSA, Las Vegas and possibly Los Angeles would not have had nearly the growth that they had, because those both needed gigantic investments in the aerospace industry and in radio communication that wouldn't have happened without them. But without Cuban exiles, that story is not particularly interesting. Add Cuban exiles, you get Miami, and that is, you know, at the bottom line of where Covert City has it right.
Joseph C. Goulden and Alexander W. Raffio bring you The Death Merchant, The Rise and Fall of Edwin P. Wilson.
Yeah, Edwin P. Wilson was a CIA agent, and his job was to set up shell corporations for the CIA. And then these shell corporations could sell arms to somebody that we weren't allowed to sell arms to, or go around having activities, or fly people back and forth on their aircraft instead of the federal government's aircraft, and in every way obfuscate CIA operations. And since the operations are already supposed to be obfuscated, he was encouraged to run the corporation at a profit. And when he ran it as a profit, he would keep a lot of the profits, it turned out. And eventually he gets fired from the CIA under murky circumstances, and then he goes to work for the NSA doing basically the same thing, and then he's fired by the NSA under murky circumstances. And at some point, one of his shell companies sells 20 tons of Semtex to Libya under Gaddafi. This is in the early 80s, and this is frowned on at the time, and so he is cashiered and prosecuted for being a spy. Or rather, for dealing with the enemy, fundamentally. And this trial happened in 1983. The book comes out in 1985. This is the case for the prosecution against Edwin P. Wilson. Now, at the time, his defense was, I was doing all this on CIA orders. 20 years later, he gets a lawyer who has got CIA clearance, who can go through all the CIA memos, and says, well, will you look at that? For a guy who was fired by the CIA, he had a lot of meetings with the CIA in the time he's allegedly committing crimes. Maybe we want to rethink that, the federal government. And so the government vacates the case rather than retry it with the new evidence out. So he walks. And the question is, to what extent was he a villain? To what extent was he a villain who was necessary? To what extent was he framed? This book will not answer that question. This book is all about, he's a bads man and we put him down. But still, you can take that story and use it for any number of espionage games, even before you get to the but was he question, which makes the specific case of Edwin Wilson fun.
If you write espionage games, you need a source on every intelligence agency around the world. And Oyster, the story of the Australian Secret Intelligence Service by Brian Toohey and William Pinwell, gets you down under spies.
Yeah, I mean, you've basically listed the reason to buy this book. I had no history of the ASIS. Now I do have a history of the ASIS. I know nothing about whether or not Oyster is hissing in a byword in Australian circles, but it is the only history of the ASIS that has come across my transom. So now I own it. And, you know, again, you got stuff going down in the Pacific Ocean. Maybe the Aussies are the guys who are on top of it, not the CIA or not the Chinese.
Now, the next four books are all going to go in radically different shelves.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is Anatomy of Wonder, A Critical Guide to Science Fiction, 5th edition by Neil Barron.
Yeah, this is a standard reference work. Neil Barron, from his own critical sensibility and from other histories of the field, has assembled roughly, I think, 1,000 books that are core to science fiction. And he summarizes them in two paragraphs. He provides modest bibliographic data on them and relates them sometimes to other books in the field. So, for example, you know, in the write-up on Dune, he says, you know, see also, you know, James Blish, see also Robert Heinlein, see also Isaac Asimov, future histories, religious science fiction, etc. And this is, you know, before the internet, this was great. And even after the internet, it's good to have one set of critical eyes on everything. And it's a handsome volume, and it was not particularly expensive. So I say snapped it up. I, you know, lifting this with one wrist is not advised, but it is a good compendium and pretty good for sort of institutional study of SF, or a real quick, I don't know, what does Barron say about this book that I've never heard of, but probably he has.
For your little mentioned natural history section, we have Shadows of Existence, Discoveries and Speculations in Zoology by Matthew A. Beale.
Yeah, this is one of those that is about cryptids and about, like, okapis and Tasmanian wolves and things. So it's some of them are creatures that you probably should not be leaning on, and some of them, like Loch Ness monsters, and some of them are just, hey, here's a weird species of owl. So it's...
I try not to lean on owls either, actually.
I don't want to lean on owls either, per se, but it's good to know about them. This is just a guy who's written a bunch of, you know, little natural history essays, as you say. Some of them are cryptids, which is why I picked it up, but, you know, it's always good to have something about the world's smallest frog. Who doesn't care about that? So I don't know that Matthew Billy is necessarily the great zoologist authority, but he has certainly put together a nice little book. And again, one that you can pick up relatively affordably.
Well, if we're already throwing in cryptids, this makes me all the more curious for The Resurrectionist, The Lost Work of Dr. Spencer Black by E.B. Hudspeth.
Yeah, this is sort of a faux journal. Dr. Spencer Black is fictional. Dr. Spencer Black apparently believed that all of these ancient imaginary animals really existed. And so the way to prove that was he built them in his mysterious lab. And then he would exhibit them in carnivals. And then, of course, sadly, he dies. I don't think he dies being torn apart by his chimeras. But the big last chunk of the book is very careful anatomical drawings of the Sphinx, the Siren, the Satyr, Minotaur, Chimera, Cerberus, Pegasus, the Chinese dragon, but Dr. Black doesn't hold with fire breathing, I guess, the Centaur and the Harpy. And so the question is, what price does a book have to come down to before you will buy it just for the cool anatomical drawings? I mean, again, I say nothing against E.B. Hudspeth's faux biography talents, but what's drawing you in is those cool anatomical drawings, and that's what drew me in, and that's why I bought it.
Finally, we come to A Scheme of Heaven, The History of Astrology and the Search for Our Destiny in Data by Alexander Boxer.
Yeah, this is not a history of astrology. This is a history of Western astrology. There's nothing about Indian astrology. There's nothing about Chinese astrology. It's just from Egypt to now. And I picked it up basically because I don't actually have a history of astrology that goes all the way down through our modern time, the Age of Aquarius, etc. And it does address things like the Arabic contribution to astrology. It doesn't start with, you know, the Enlightenment, the way that a lot of orthodox occult histories do. So I also kind of enjoyed the notion that astrology was the old algorithm that, you know, well, I guess I must like birds. I'm a Libra or whatever, which is fun. Again, I don't know to what extent this puts together a satisfying through narrative, but all the places that Boxer stops in the table of contents are places that I could see stopping. I was a little disappointed that Asian astrology doesn't come in at all. But again, you've only got so much space, and it's probably better to over-concentrate on the West, since that is what most people know about, and in fact, what I generally care about more.
Right. Well, I'm a Libra, and you can tell that I care about birth because, as previously mentioned, I don't lean on owls.
Right.
Which is my way of saying these segments always run long. So let's end this segment and this episode, but be back for another episode a mere week from today. Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Pelgrane Press.
Arc Dream.
Flagbearer Games.
Dark Tower.
And Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Supple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/KenAndRobin.
Protect this podcast from ejection onto the New Jersey Turnpike by joining such backers as
Ariel Celeste,
Ginge,
Jeffrey Pittman,
Chris Lydon,
and Shihiro Yamada.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Ken and Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Celebrate your joy of missing out with our latest design, Jomo.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindlaws.bisky.social.
See you next time when, once again, we will talk about stuff.